This episode of Where Did the Road Go is brought to you in part by our Patreons. If you want to become a patron, go to wheredidtheroadgo.com. And now our show.
Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight, I am presenting you with the second part of my conversation with Aaron Daba. And in continuing with his collection of weird stories, we have a bunch of very haunting telegraphy stories. We'll get into a little bit about what that is. And times when insects were actually on trial in a court of law. Yeah, because Aaron collects the best stories. You can find more about Aaron at esoterix.com. And that's esoterx.com. And the subtitle is, If Monsters Don't Exist, Then Why Are They Out to Get Me? Such an enormous collection of fun articles there. Weird stuff that you've probably never heard of before. So, again, this is Aaron Daba. This is part two. And if you are a Patreon, I put up this week the extra segment I did with him about ghosts in the courtroom. I can't remember what. I think that was the demons one. Yeah, I don't know. I know it was interesting. I just don't remember all the details. But yeah, if you want to become a patron for $3 a month, you'll have access to that, plus a bunch of other stuff. Without any further ado, here we go. Part two.
So here's what I got for you. I've got the fact that hell is for radio telegraphers. I have a traditional ghost story of a creepy railroad tower. I've got a thing about James Campbell Beasley and his discovery of an Amazonian telegraph system.
Huh.
And there's the story of the occult experiments in quantum entangled snails.
Wow. Okay. I gotta go with the snails. They're all interesting sounding, but I gotta go with the snails.
Well, as it turns out, the French occultist Jacques Toussaint Benoit had kind of an unhealthy obsession with snails. Not that I know what a healthy obsession with snails looks like, but
right.
And he also was already dabbling in the occult, so sort of mild fascination with how snails reproduce was probably the least of his problems. A lot of other stuff bouncing around in his head. But he picked up on a piece of fairly standard occult wisdom, the notion of sympathy, you know, and sympathetic, mm-hmm. in terms of sympathetic magic. And that, coupled with his somewhat intensive and, in my mind, disturbing observations regarding the mating habits of snails, came up with a wacky but philosophically consistent hypothesis. And that's that, well, a little background. He was a French patriot in the 19th century, and he was looking for a way to improve wartime communications. And
okay.
He figured he'd happened upon something with snails that would forever after be referred to as the snail telegraph. And he called it the Pasolinic Sympathetic Compass, if I'm pronouncing that right. Pasolinic
Sympathetic
Compass, which was ultimately a failure, but some say it was also a deliberate hoax. But you know, if you read closely enough, it kind of sounds a little bit like what they're talking about with quantum communication these days. So, the quick and dirty explanation. He had, of course, never heard of quantum entanglement and probably wouldn't care if he had. The 1840s, in which time which he was experimenting, kind of sucked in Europe. crop failures, food shortages, food riots, revolutions in France, Germany, Italy, and Austria, Hungary. Things were just not looking pretty good. And peace on earth wasn't looking like a priority. Britain and France were dominating European politics, and Russia and Prussia were making a lot of noise, and war seemed imminent. And everybody was worried about passing information around. And, you know, we've come up with lots of ways to do that. Flags, lights, and all sorts of other things were being used in the 1840s to sort of signal long distances. And people were playing around with electrical signaling. And so the Scotsmen tried it as early as 1753. But, you know, the problem with a lot of the sort of physical kinds of signaling is that you need good weather, clear skies, sober guys at the right. Four towers, you know, that kind of stuff, which you're unlikely to get at any given time. And the idea that Benoit came up with was, and he was working with a French-American guy named Biot Chretien, I believe was his name. And I'm, again, probably mispronouncing these names, and I'm sorry any French right. speakers out there. I apologize. But they decided that they could come up with a means of telegraphing by snails. And and not at this, you know, in the 1780s, 1790s, not too far in the distant past from these experiments that these two were doing in the 1850s, they had discovered, you know, Galvani figured out that you could, you know, electrocute a dead toad and its legs would twitch. So people were talking
right.
about animal electricity, and it seemed pretty cool. and so people were looking into it. And of course, at the same time, you have the sort of revival of a lot of occultism. And, you know, put a little animal electricity and occultism together, and what do you get? You get the snail telegraph. And the snail telegraph, it was because the, you know, they started, actually, there's a precursor to the snail telegraph, and that's the powder of sympathy. That was the 17th century version of it. It's where they your alchemist would put together some weird concoction, and they would apply it to a weapon, and they'd cut a dog. You know, and these guys were obviously not nice, and put the dog on the boat, and on a boat, and the boat would go off sailing. And they would then wound the dog and be able to tell that there was where something was in the world by wounding the dog.
Huh.
I mean, which, of course, is absolutely silly, but you know, they needed to... To solve, they hadn't solved the longitude problem yet. You know, you could fix your latitude, but you couldn't fix your longitude very easily. So, you know, you send the wounded dog along board your sailing ship, and some reliable individual stays on shore and dips a piece of bandage used on the dog to bandage the wound into a solution of the powder. And presumably every time he did that, the dog would yelp, and then the ship would know what time it is, and then they'd know what the longitude was, because that's how they eventually solve the longitude problem, that you have to know what time it is, and then you can tell what longitude you're at. So not at all well and good, except that, you know, they hadn't really thought of snails yet. And Benoit decided that the electrical telegraph was working pretty well on dry land. By the time he started experimenting, the optical telegraph was okay. They'd even laid some undersea cables connecting France and England, but communicating across the ocean was getting to be a real problem. They had to figure out how to do that. And Benoit had the notion that certain species of snail formed a permanent telepathic bond when they mated. And details are a little bit sparse on how he came to that conclusion. But like I said, he had an unhealthy obsession with snail mating. So it's obviously he spent a lot of time staring at them. And what he did is he did a lot of forced mating and poking of snails. and decided that you could communicate based on this notion of sympathetic reactions, and that these snails, once they mated, had some sort of what he called the terrestrial galvanic current or animal sympathetic current. And you could derive this new force from that, for which you could use to telegraph messages back and forth. And so all I had to do at this point, now that I'd come up with this great theory, was build a snail telegraph. And Benoit obviously, you know, was lacking in capital, as, you know, he spent most of his time staring at snails. His partner, Beat Schretien, who was a shadowy figure. Nobody really had ever seen this guy, apparently. Benoit convinced a certain Monsieur Triat to provide a lab space for him so he could prove this. And he experimented for a year without showing any results. And Triat started to get suspicious that maybe the money he was investing in this was not the best money he'd ever spent. But Benoit finally offered a demonstration and invited a reporter, Jules Ali, to see what happened. And basically what it consisted of was a complicated set of metallic plates and holes in them with wheels and circular discs and steel axes. And of course, at the center of all this, in a solution of sulfate and copper, was a living snail. And supposedly, the snail this apparatus was also set up on the across the ocean with Benoit's shadowy compatriot Beat, and he was going to prove that he could send a message from Paris to the U.S. Through snail. And he spent a lot of time poking the snails and moving back and forth between the snail and telling everybody that everything was working just fine. But nobody's ever able to prove that the snail could communicate messages to the other snail.
Right.
It's a episode where you mix a little bit of occultism and a little bit of science, and you come up with some very weird ideas until you start thinking about what they're talking about now, which is that quantum entanglement of particles, that spooky communication at a distance, this kind of thing where it flips without any apparent kind of communication. So maybe, just maybe, he was prefiguring some of this based on the snails.
All right, that does explain quantum entangled snails. Wow. Huh. All right. What were the other ones there?
Oh, how about hell is for radio telegraphers?
All right, sounds good.
Okay. So there's, one morning I'm sitting around, I'm reading a 1902 edition of the Railroad Telegrapher magazine over coffee. You know, I do that kind of thing. And which happened to be the organ of the labor union, the Order of Railroad Telegraphers, which was an important union until we came up with fancy things like radio and telephones, and radio railroad telegraphy went away. The thing about railroad telegraphy is that it often veered into the very creepy, and in 1902, George Clark was basically just a mild-mannered radio telegrapher working out of St. Louis, Missouri, and not really doing anything important, and kind of bored with his life. And he found himself lounging about the office, his feet on the desk, probably having a cold beer or something like that. But strangely, he kept tapping on the table the same thing over and over again with his hand in Morse code. It was C-A-C-A-C-A. Now, I, for the life of me, have not been able to determine what exactly that is. I assume it was a call sign. The problem is when you start trying to research abbreviations in 19th century telegraphy, there's a lot of different systems they used.
I'm sure.
It gets kind of hard to figure out. So somebody out there who's like a historian of radio telegraphy, railroad telegraphy, can probably tell us what exactly that is. But as he's tapping this out on the table, involuntarily, he can't stop himself. He keeps noticing, and imagine these radio telegraphers, they were in contact with other radio telegraphers, and they started to recognize patterns in each other's the Morse code, the way that people tapped out their Morse code. Mm-hmm. And finally, he tapped out a very clear hello CA. And since that was his call sign, obviously somebody was trying to talk to him. And that's, you know, that's kind of unnerving. And then it started to tap out, hello, CA, I've been calling you for a long time, and then tapped out, ha, ha, ha. And George recognized that immediately. That was a telegraph operator he knew named Steve Fordham. And he started up a conversation with him. And there's only one real problem with that, and that's that Steve Fordham had been dead for a while.
Yeah, I figured.
He was apparently, according to reports, cowardly shot to death on the main street of a small town in eastern Tennessee. After his conversation, he has a short conversation with the dead Steve Fordham via Morse.
Now, did he know he was dead?
He did know he was dead, yes.
Okay.
The last words of Steve Fordham were, give my 73 to my friends, which I did actually track down and was able to figure out. That means give my compliments. I don't know what the origins of that are. Again, we need a railroad telegraph historian to hop in at any time and let us know. But Mr. Clark has discovered, you know, again, this is the time of spiritualism, and has discovered this version of automatic writing in the form of automatic telegraphy. Mm-hmm. And with his newfound power, he decides, guess what? I'm going to try and contact other dead telegraph operators. And so he tried lots and lots of long deceased acquaintances that he'd known in the railroad communication business. And he could always raise Steve Fordham, but he didn't seem to be able to get anybody else. And he was moved from Missouri to New England, and he was became acquainted with another local telegraph operator named Kitty, a faithful Christian woman, is reported. And upon her death, George tried to contact her and was able to contact her. She assured him that she was at home and at peace. Now, this presented a very a strange problem for George, and that's that of all the many telegraph operators that he was acquainted with, he only seemed to be able to connect to two. And the conclusion he drew from that, which not entirely unreasonable conclusion, is that those two radio telegraphers were in heaven and all the others were not.
Well, I'll say this, though. The fact that he couldn't just contact everyone tells me that whatever was going on was probably, at least on his part, legitimate. You know, he wasn't making these extraordinary. He was puzzled by the fact that he couldn't contact these other people.
Yeah, or God hates radio telegraphers.
And maybe.
I worry about things like that. It's like, I'm glad I didn't go into railroad telegraphy. I mean, I personally, you know, when I told my guidance counselor I wanted to be a rail baron, she was not amused, but it was the 70s. Railroads
aren't very big. Huh, that's probably the first time she heard that.
And I ended up a tech guy, and if I was alive in 1902 and was a tech guy, I'd probably be a radio telegrapher.
Fair enough. Okay, so what were the other options there?
Okay, we've got the amazing Amazonian telegraph discovered by James Besley, and we've got the creepy ghost story of a bunch of guys in a isolated railroad telegraph tower.
Let's do the Amazonian one first.
All right, so James Campbell Besley, which poor guy does not even have a Wikipedia page. Can you believe that? I mean, it's just plain insulting if you're a historical figure. I mean, he's long dead, or else he'd probably have big self-esteem issues. But
right.
This guy was the epitome of the adventurous Victorian gentleman. And he happened to have discovered that there was a rudimentary system of wireless telegraphy that existed in South America's Amazon Valley 2,000 years before Marconi got the Nobel Prize for it in 1909.
Hmm.
Now, Besley's interesting in himself. I mean, he spent his childhood in South Africa and Australia, returned to England, graduated Oxford, went off to Australia, hit the gold fields in Kalgoorlie, made a lot of money that way, headed off for the Klondike gold rush in Alaska. And it's said that he pocketed about $250,000 worth of gold.
Wow.
Then he enlisted in the Kitchener's Flying Scouts in the Boer War, which basically involved carrying military dispatches like across 120 miles of enemy territory.
Man.
And then, I mean, it was basically one, a pretty bad dude. You know, he got around. And then after that, he went to Mexico and set up a silver and copper mining operation and a 50,000 acre cattle ranch. And this is all while the Mexican Revolution raged around him. And sometime in between there, he won the 1913 Pacific Coast Polo Open in Southern California.
Jeez.
And so he had enough gold. He had all the polo trophies he could do anything with. And so he decided to hop down to Peru and explore the headwaters of the Amazon in 1913. So after rafting about 4,000 miles of the Amazon River to the Atlantic, he found three Inca cities that had not been discovered before, cannibalized remains of earlier explorers. He survived malaria, vampire bats, snowstorms. He managed to take the first motion pictures of Machu Picchu in 1911.
Oh, wow.
I mean, this is a dude who like would make Indiana Jones blush. And like, he came back to New York City with a monkey named Changa, who he taught to order room service for him at the Waldorf Hotel, is the rumor. And in 1913, all the stuff that he brought back, the film and the artifacts from his Amazon expedition, were stolen.
Yeah.
And this, of course, this guy was such a tough dude. He headed back to Peru in 1914 to reshoot the whole thing.
So wow.
He did it all again. But then he came back with a new cargo to New York, and his ship was rammed and sunk in New York Harbor. And he managed to save the cargo this time, though. So, you know, it's kind of weird that he's faded into such obscurity that, like, even Wikipedia can't find him now.
Yeah.
But one of his big accomplishments was that he noticed that everywhere in the Amazon, his presence was already announced. Wherever his party went, the natives already seemed to know he was there. And he didn't understand how such rapid communication was happening. And when he asked the natives, they said, well, how's this happening? They said, wireless, just like you guys. And He said, what? And they explained to him that they'd had their own form of wireless telegraphy for more than 3,000 years. And that that they simply, you know, were telling other, the next tribe over that he was coming by using their version of wireless. And what their version of wireless, Besley said, was it looked like a crude arrangement suspended between two tree stumps on a horizontal bar, and they would tap on a hollowed tree trunk that base was slightly off ground, and inside had been arranged with strings like a violin. And they said when the instrument was struck with a rubber hammer, the vibration created a wave that carried for miles over the hills, and that the receivers were similar to the transmitter. They would just vibrate according to what was hit. And so understanding the sound system, one tribe could communicate with the other. And I love this because this is like, here's something we, you know, pat ourselves on the back in 1909 for being so smart to invent, but, you know, with a few hollowed out trees and some jaguar gut strings, you know?
Yeah.
They came up with the same thing in the Amazon.
And it almost sounds radar-ish in a sense.
Yeah.
Because it's bouncing back, right?
Yeah. Well, if you think about it, it's like, I know I couldn't build a wireless telegraph system out of hollowed tree and leopard guts.
No.
I'm impressed. You know? It's a good idea.
But there is a lot of ancient sound technology in the ancient world, I mean, that we don't fully understand today. So, I mean, that it kind of makes sense.
Yeah. Right. So, funny thing is, like, ask somebody to explain how telegraphy works today, and they can't tell you that either. So it's
true. Okay, so we had one creepy one, right?
I have a very creepy one. This comes from a article I wrote called "I've Been Working on the Creepy Railroad," and back in 1851, railroad companies in the U.S. Started using telegraphy to coordinate the arrival and departure of trains. And the reason for this is because prior to that, the whole U.S. rail system was single-tracked. You had to be really careful dispatching trains to avoid either, you know, head-on collisions between two trains going in opposite directions and back-end collisions with trains going in opposite. Or going in the same. So what they used up until then was they called it a time interval dispatching system, which is basically send a train out and then wait. Which, you know,
all right.
You wait enough time so that, you know, the other train can get far enough that you're not going to run into the back of it. Which, you know, perfectly reasonable, except that they kept running into each other and you had lots of train accidents. The obvious solution to this is our modern solution, the two-track train system, with each train going in a different direction on a different track. But that required laying double tracks everywhere, and that costs a lot of money, and it doesn't solve the problem of trains headed in the same direction.
Right.
More cost-effective solution at that point was to come up with these telegraph stations, which... railroad telegraph stations where they could say the train just passed X location and, you know, and it's currently 9 p.m. and, you know, somebody could tell them, well, it's it just passed us here now, so it's safe to let another train go. I mean, it's a reasonable use of communication technology. And that brings us to Dale, Georgia. And the great thing about Dale, Georgia is it never actually existed. Well, I mean, it existed. It was one building, and that one building was a radio telegraph tower. There was nothing else. It was about 7 miles south of Savannah on the main line of the Atlantic Coast Railroad. And Dale, Georgia was a telegraph tower, and the nearest human habitation was a quarter of a mile away. So what you've got is a little tower next to a railroad track in the middle of a pine forest, inhabited by three railroad telegraph operators for 3 months of the year and otherwise deserted, because starting in January, the northern tourists would flock to Florida much as they do now.
Right.
And it would, they would pass through Dale, Georgia. And so for those few months, they would need the telegraph operators because of the high traffic of trains coming through to avoid collisions. But, you know, the middle of a lonely pine forest, only three operators there for 3 months of a year, and then it's deserted the rest of the year and nobody nearby. I mean, that's just plain recipe for a horror movie, right?
Yeah, definitely.
So along come comes the 1911 season, where some young telegraph operators, their last names were Bright, Davis, and Clark, arrived at the Dale Tower to open for the season. And Dale already had kind of a weird reputation among railroad men who passed through the area. There was a man who was killed by a train near the tower, and his body was laid to rest across the track. And after that, brakemen would report strange noises when they pulled up on the sidetrack there. And sometimes when they tried to pull out from the sidetrack, they'd find their train uncoupled in multiple places with no explanation. Most of the brakemen on the railroad wouldn't even enter the tower. So we got remote location, we got horrible death, we got history of hauntings, right? All we need is a killer clown. We got a B movie, right? But Bright, Davis, and Clark, you know, basically being a radio telegrapher in 1911 is a pretty good paying job. And so, you're not going to be too daunted by reputations of hauntings and things like that. I mean, we'll put up with a lot these days for a living wage. You can imagine in 1911 what you'd put up with.
Right.
So when they arrived in the tower, noticed it already had somebody there. He was, of course, dead, decaying. It was the corpse of an anonymous hobo who had sought shelter there, obviously, and from the cold, and inconsiderately died without cleaning up. And they gave him a good burial on the other side of the tracks from the tower, which, you know, in the end, now you got two deaths and a graveyard basically sitting across the tracks from the tower. And that's,
yeah,
it's like, if you could like list the things not to do if you don't want to encounter angry ghosts, this would probably be high on the list. The first things occurred, they were not terribly scary things that were happening. There were like trap doors that were flinging open, fastenings with, they'd fasten the trap doors with nails and an iron bar and it'd still fly open. They'd hear footsteps on the stairs, even though all three of them were in the top of the tower. The raising and lowering of window sashes in the upper tower in full view of the three occupants and no one being near the window. And they were pretty sure that there was some sort of trickster doing something to them. So they, they would do stuff like securely fasten the shades and the doors, and no precaution whatsoever, seemed to have any effect. And soon they reported that various articles began to be levitated about the room in broad daylight. And then a can of condensed milk lifted itself into the air, and a large dish pan lifted itself and rolled down the stairs out of the tower and under it. And a lantern levitated from the desk. A can opener flew wildly about it. I mean, it's a long litany of just weird things happening. Bolts and taps and such things as used in railroad construction. They'd get hurled through the windows of the Dale Tower. And I actually have a picture of the Dale Tower. It's just like sitting in the middle of nowhere. It is a creepy looking thing.
Now, is it a tower like these, like a wilderness tower is, or, where it's like on stilts, or is it a tower?
It's not even really a tower. It's like a two floor building, just a small two floor building. Probably just enough room for, a radio telegraph and some beds for the operators and a kitchen. I mean, it looks like a little tiny townhouse in the middle of nowhere. There's nothing around this thing.
Okay.
So unfortunately, things started to escalate, as they do. The objects were being hurled around the tower so consistently that the three guys had to often run out of the tower and abandon it before they got hit in the head. And on two occasions, Mr. Bright, one of the guys of the Bright Davis Clark trio, and maybe he was living up to his name, walked 7 miles to Savannah, and he intended to resign his position because he was tired of dealing with what was obviously a poltergeist. When he got there, he found he was too embarrassed to admit the reason. So he returned to Dale Tower. And Bright, Davis, and Clark, they figured something had to be done. So this is where, for me, it gets even weirder, is that they started doing some experiments. They would take a pack of ordinary playing cards and toss it from the window in the belief, and part of this was also they figured the cards somehow were involved in this. I'm not sure why they came to that conclusion, but they tossed them out the window, and they found them in a bag of rice returned to them. They tried it with the case for the cards, and they found that in a canister of coffee with the lid tightly closed. And they then decided to throw the cards out as a fast train whizzed past, hoping that they would be crushed beneath the wheels of the engine, but they found it in a bed a moment later. So, they're abusing this poor deck of cards, and obviously it had no effect. But these guys were, obviously they were committed to this job because they decided to try and rid themselves in the tower of what they had now assumed to be a poltergeist. And it's reported that they set about burning sulfur inside the tower. Now I took a little look into that because that seems like a rather smelly and dangerous kind of thing to do. It seems that modern witches say that's the traditional way to exorcise negative spirits. But sulfur smoke is poisonous, most reasonable people look for something a little, you look for their spectral countermeasures and something that's a little less, sulfur content.
And it's interesting in Joshua Cutchin's book on paranormal smells, sulfur is the most common smell you will pick up around paranormal encounters. So it's funny that would also be saying that would banish it.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because that's why garlic probably is so closely associated with various, occult warding kind of stuff because it's high in sulfur content. Yet not toxic like burning sulfur. So burn garlic, don't burn sulfur.
You'll just smell fair enough.
You'll smell like an Italian restaurant. But what's interesting is that it seemed to work. After they burn the sulfur in the tower, and I hopefully let it air out for a year or two, it would apparently there were no more reports of poltergeists.
All right. A little disappointing, really, that it would, just stop like that.
No, hey, effective tools are always a good thing.
Is it, and that place is still standing?
I don't believe the tower is still standing. It might be. I mean, the picture I found of it was probably from 1920s, 30s. I suspect it's gone by now. It might still be there, though. Some savvy person from Savannah might be able to tell us.
Interesting. All right. That was the last one from the Weird Telegraphy, right?
Yes, that is. I strongly suspect I have one or two other Weird Telegraphy ones, but I off the top of my head, I'm.
That's fine.
I think those are my best ones. There's a lot of weird. a lot of this, the Radio Telegrapher, that magazine I was talking about, weird stuff like that got printed in this just completely random, like, union magazine.
So let's move on to Insects on Trial.
Okay. Do you want to talk about insects being a trial about insect excommunication, or a deal that was cut with insects over not eating the grapes?
Let's go with the grapes.
Let's go with the grapes. All right. The this one is from about 1545, and it occurred in St. Julien, which is somewhere in the Rhone commune, noted for its excellence in its vintages in France. The complaint is well documented. It was put before an ecclesiastical court chaired by one Francis Bonivard, through a legal representative named Pierre Ducal. And the defendant in the case was a herbivorous species of weevil. So it was St. Julien versus weevils was the case. And weevils obviously don't typically seek representation.
Right.
And I think it's mostly because they don't have pockets and they don't have any resources with which to hire counsel. But
right.
You know, they were pretty fair in these ecclesiastical courts, so they assigned counsel, two gentlemen, Pierre Falcone and Claude Morel, to the defense of the weevils.
Okay.
The problem was that the weevils had been eating up all the grapes, ruining the wonderful vineyards of the St. Julien area. And Bonivard, the prosecutor, considered, or rather Bonivard, that wasn't the prosecutor, he was the chair of the court, considered the opening arguments and declined to pass sentence at first, and issued a 1546 proclamation. These things are all, we have these things, so we know about them. And he recommended, he said, we really aren't going to sue the weevils here. We need recourse to public prayer, and thought that prosecuting the weevils, in as much as that God probably made the weevils too, not solely for the sustenance of rational human beings, but for, you know, insects as well, you know,
he made birds
for everything, that it would be unbecoming to proceed against the weevils because they're just doing what weevils do, right? So I said, it's more fitting for you guys to go, you know, plead for the mercy of heaven and implore pardon for your sins. You know, judge is basically saying, I don't try weevils. and he had some pretty specific instructions what he wanted them to do, which of course involved unfeigned contrition, repent all sins, live justly and charitably, most importantly, pay their tithes. and march in solemn procession around the vineyards, and at least he mandated at least two persons from each St. Julien household should participate in these exercises. And so St. Julien went ahead and did all of this, and it was reported that upon successful completion, the weevils disappeared, which is great. Except that in 1587, the weevils wound up back before the court. Yeah, and this time they also were afforded representation, and making reference back to the earlier 1546 decision, this new 1587 case against the weevils pointed out that formerly by and this is a quote from the decision, formerly by virtue of defined services and earnest supplications, the scourge and inordinate fury of the aforesaid animals did cease. Now they have resumed their depredations and are doing incalculable injury. they were beseeching the court again to proceed with excommunication of the Weevils and to demand that they stop their depredations on the wine crops of St. Julian. And, you know, the St. Julian people felt they'd been reasonably charitable, church-going, you know, folks for the 30 years since the last lawsuit. And they felt that the Weevils had made some theological miscalculation about God's will and thus deserved excommunication. And, you know, this is the, you know, this is right in the middle of the Renaissance and, you know, humanism, you know, where man is the measure of all things is kind of the standard of the day. And right. St. Vintners aren't about to like coddle a bunch of heretical Weevils. And so they went to court. And this time, two more advocates were assigned to the Weevils. And the Weevils said, well, the Weevils, through their representation, argued that they, again, had also been created by God and had the right to feed on grass. And for all these and other good reasons, the Weevils were in their right when they occupied the vineyards of the commune. And they simply availed themselves of a legitimate privilege conformable to divine and natural law, which is, you know, a pretty good argument. And the plaintiff's retort was that, you know, the Bible and common sense that animals are here for the utility of man and we should they have no right to cause loss to us. And the council for the insects said that we had no right to command animals. We had the right to command animals, but not the right to persecute or excommunicate them, which is an interesting, subtle argument, which means basically you can stomp on them, but you can't excommunicate them.
Right.
So the judges were very impressed with the defense arguments, and it looked like, you know, the folks in St. Julian were headed for another round of you know, repentance and you know, paying their tithes and things like that.
Right.
But the mayor of St. Julian stepped forward with a really novel solution to the problem. He offered the Weevils a deal. Or through the Weevils Council, he offered the Weevils a deal.
Right.
And he was willing to offer them what was effectively a Weevil preserve, a plot of land ceded to them in perpetuity, but preserving a right of way for humans across the territory. But otherwise, they could have everything else. Where they could live out the rest of their days in peace and security on the condition that the Weevils agreed to vacate the vineyards and accept excommunication from the Catholic Church should they return, which is, you know, not a terrible idea. And the crack legal team for the Weevils accepted the deal, because, I mean, you can't really pass that up. But the legal wrangling didn't actually end there, because one of the Weevil advocates, Antoine Filio, on 1587 declared that he could not in good conscience accept the offer on behalf of the Weevils, as he had inspected the land set aside for them and found it sterile and unwelcoming. So the lawyer for the St. Julian said that it's admirably adapted. It has lots of trees, shrubs, and all sorts of stuff, and that the court experts could examine the property and it would be just fine. Now, we don't actually know the results of this trial. We don't know what happened. There's a set of 29 documents with a very long Latin name that I don't even want to try to pronounce. But they're the court records of this Weevil trial. So the reason we don't know why is even more suspicious, and that's that the last pages of these 29 documents were suspiciously eaten by bugs.
Of course they are.
So essentially, the bugs physically annulled the judgment of the court, so we don't know what it was. So when attempts to have the Weevils excommunicated failed, you know, they brokered an agreement, and then you know, they had a precarious detente with the Weevils, and the Weevils made sure that that nobody would ever remember the results of the trial, probably so they could come back in another 40 years.
All right, then. What year was this from?
This the actual case was in the first case was in 1546. The second case, I believe, was 1587.
Wow.
And to this day, we don't know whether the Weevils are planning a comeback or not.
Yes, how do you get... Yeah. All right, so you had one other insect in the courtroom, I think?
I do indeed. This is a kind of odd one.
Unlike the last one.
Oh, yeah. The other one seems completely normal to me. This one's a little odd. and this one happened in Brazil. And it was a bunch of... let me back up. The Friars Minor of St. Anthony, they're a Franciscan order, right? And they're setting up in the 18th century, opening the 18th century at least, they were setting up missions all over Brazil. And in one particular part of Brazil, it's called Prudade no Maranhão, they were building a monastery. And once the monastery was built, they had ant problems. And they unwisely took those local ants to court for violations of their property rights. And what they didn't expect was that the ants were ready for them. Now, particularly strange thing about this is the Order of St. Francis of Assisi is, you know, St. Francis himself is generally regarded as patron saint of animals. But it turns out, a little bit of research, St. Francis, while he liked animals, really actually disliked ants a lot. Hmm. And there's a work by a companion of his, an Italian Franciscan monk, where he says the ants were not so pleasing to St. Francis as other living beings because of their great diligence, which seems a little strange to me, in gathering together and storing up in the time of summer a treasure of grain for the winter. There is a theological reason for this. It's that they weren't placing themselves in the hands of God, you know, and relying on that. They were storing up and not relying on God's providences, which, you know, theologically you can find some... Well, theological arguments get funky sometimes, but you can sort of see
where it comes from.
So that's why it's particularly surprising that this order, which was an order of St. Francis, he'd been long dead when this trial came up. So we can't be sure what sort of like amicus curiae he would have submitted, but probably would have been against the ants since he didn't like them. But biggest problem was that they dug nice cellars under the foundations to store staple foods like flour of their monastery, and the local ants had discovered that was pretty tasty.
Sure.
And they were the local ants are large, numerous, and in the words of the monks during the trial, in order to enlarge the limits of their subterranean empire, undermine the cellars of the brethren, burrowing beneath the foundations, and they weakened the walls because so many of them burrowed underneath, and carried off the flour. Which had been kept for, you know, food for the monks. And the monks were in the peril of famine as a result of this. You know, you're in the middle of the jungle, in the middle of Brazil, trying to set up a monastery, and the ants are stealing your food. You get a little angry. And so you say, what do? You know, well, you take them to court, apparently. Now, there are trial records of this, and that's, I always love it when there are trial records because you find really strange things. It's 12 volumes of transactions of some English society. They translated records from the Nova Floresta, Portuguese history from 1728 that details the trial. If you're Latin or French or Portuguese or up to snuff, you can go read it in the original. But there are not a lot of English translations. A lot of English translations are excerpts. But the ecclesiastical trial of the Brazilian ants proceeded. And again, you know, these ecclesiastical courts, they're fair. They assign counsel to the plaintiffs, the monks, and counsel to the defendants, the ants. And the counsel for the plaintiffs argued that the jungle was inhospitable. They were gathering supplies for the faithful, and the inconvenience of the ants, who they claimed had whose morals and manner of life were clearly contrary to gospel precepts, and that's a bit of a reach. They also said that they lived by fraud, and not content with acts of larceny, proceeded to open violence and endeavors to ruin the house. And there's a lot to lay on the ants. consequently, the prosecution was asking for some sort of divine pestilence or more instrumental means of extermination. They wanted a good smiting to happen to the ants. Now, the defense for the ants had a fascinating argument, considering that we're talking about 1713. And that's this particular Franciscan attorney. I don't know if he's an attorney. He's in ecclesiastical court. I don't think they call them attorneys. But the defense, the equivalent of the Franciscan defense attorney for the ants, said, of course, used some of the similar arguments that the weevil counsel used, and that as ants were endowed with life, they were compelled to preserve said life with the instincts implanted in them. Mm-hmm. And the ants, in their displeasing behavior, were actually displaying some rather admirable qualities: prudence, diligence, and charity in aiding each other, which were all cardinal virtues. So he's basically being really obnoxious, this defense. And he said, given the comparative size of an ant versus a monk, their burdens often far surpass that of the monks. So he said, hey, these ants are working harder than you are. And the most fascinating argument this guy had, remembering that it's 1713 and, you know, Europe is busy colonizing the whole new world, you know, just as fast as they can. One of his arguments was his clients, the ants, had been in possession of the land long before the appellants and established themselves there, and that seizure of said territory was by simple force on the part of the Franciscans, and conducted that while it might be justifiable that the plaintiffs defend their monastery by human means, that means the monks, you know, crush the ants as they see them, that an appeal for retribution from the creator was wholly unjustifiable. So this went to the judge. And the judge said that the brethren should appoint a field in their neighborhood. Again, we got a very similar to, it looks like these guys read maybe some of the Weevil case law. And they should appoint a field in their neighborhood suitable for the habitation of the ants, and that the latter should change their abode immediately under pain of major excommunication. And that way both, you know, the ants would have their own field, and the monks would not have to worry about their food anymore, or their house being undermined by burrowing ants, which, and apparently ants in Brazil are really big and nasty, and I can imagine them burrowing under a wall and undermining it. Friar was a friar was appointed to convey this to the insects, and he did it by reading it aloud, this judgment aloud, at the openings of their burrows. And we're never told whether the ants accepted the arbitration terms, but one suspects they continued their fight against Portuguese colonial expansion. And
you just gotta marvel at stuff like that, where it's like, yeah, we'll just hold the animals to our created laws.
Well, you know, and sometimes sometimes we see too much of ourselves in them. There's a famous quote from Lewis Thomas. He's a entomologist and it's oddly also a poet. He said, ants are so much like human beings as to be an embarrassment. They farm fungi, raise aphids as livestock, launch armies into wars, use chemical sprays to alarm and confuse enemies, and capture slaves. The families of weaver ants engage in child labor, holding their larvae like shuttles to spin out the thread that sews the leaves together for their fungus gardens. They exchange information ceaselessly. They do everything but watch television.
All right, fair enough. Wow. All right. Tell people where they can find more of your stuff.
More of my stuff can be found on my website, esoterix.com, ESOTERX.com. I'm also on Tumblr, same ESOTERX.tumblr.com. And I can be found on Twitter at esoterix.
And you are not on Facebook.
I am not on Facebook. I have only so many hours in the day.
Fair enough. All right. Thank you so much, Aaron.
Oh, thank you.
All right. And there you go. Go check out Aaron at his website, esoterix.com. We'll have him back again, I'm sure, sometime relatively soon. And as I said, there was an extra segment for Patreons, about 15 minutes long, about him telling one more story. So if you're a patron, you got that as well as both parts right away, so you didn't have to wait a week. And there you go. All right, to take you out tonight, we are going to hear The Beautiful Kings. And this is a song called Secret Town. And you can find more about them at beautifulkings.com. See you next time. Thank you.
You have been listening to Where Did the Road Go? This show is made possible in part from our Patreons, and we thank you and everyone listening for helping us continue this exploration of the strange. You can always find everything Where Did the Road Go related at www.wheredidtheroadgo.com. And thank you so much for your support.